Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Episode des Begründet Glauben Podcasts. Wir sind überzeugt, dass Glaube unserem Leben Sinn gibt und dass Glaube auch logisch Sinn ergibt. Die heutige Episode ist eine Kooperation mit dem Glaube ist fragwürdig Podcast. Wir wünschen gute Inspiration.
A warm welcome to Belief is Question Worthy. In today's episode, we want to talk about the climate change, and we have invited a real expert to join us. Welcome, Catherine Hayhu.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, let's get to know you a little bit better. I'll pass over to Hannah for that.
Yes, thank you. It's a great honor. Catherine, you were born in 1972 in Toronto, in Canada. And you are a world-renowned climate scientist, professor at Texas Tech University, and chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy. You are widely regarded as one of the most influential voices in the fight against climate change. You have made groundbreaking contributions to regional climate modeling, and you focus on the impacts of climate change on water, health, and other topics. You serve as a leader author for the U.S. National Climate Assessment, which is one of the most authoritative reports on climate impacts in the U.S. You are recognized for your exceptional communication skills. You have been named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people, and you have received prestigious honors such as the Stephen H. Schneider Award for Climate Communication and the UN Champion for the Earth Award. Your book, Saving Us, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope and Healing in a Divided World from 2021, has been praised for bridging divides and inspiring action. You're also a sought-after speaker and media contributor, frequently featured in outlets such as the New York Times, BBC, and National Geographic. Your ability to translate complex science into relatable narratives, which you might need today, that has earned you respect across diverse audiences, including policymakers, business leaders, and faith communities. And your work exemplifies the fusion of rigorous science, effective communication, and a commitment to fostering collaboration in addressing the climate crisis. And I'm very glad to meet you, and I think we have a great talk today.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you. And like you said, I serve as the chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy, which is a global organization that works on climate and biodiversity, and their European offices are in Berlin.
That's nice. Catherine, it's a really important topic we want to talk about, climate change. And our questions today do not represent our own positions. It's more a collection of critical questions that are raised against climate research. I think you said it in the short talk before that you've heard nearly all arguments and questions, and we've picked the top questions, so to say, and we are curious to hear what you have to say to that. Let's dive right back into 2013, Barack Obama tweeted that 97% of scientists say that climate change is real, that it is human-made, and it is dangerous. Was that true then, and is it still true today?
It was true then. It was based on research asking scientists who studied climate-related topics if they agreed that climate was changing, humans were responsible, and the impacts were serious. And today, we're much further on, that number is higher. Some estimated at over 99%. And speaking for myself, I know the names of thousands of scientists, and I know a few that would disagree with, is it real? Is it human-caused? Is it serious? I can count the number of scientists who would disagree with that using less than 5 fingers. So imagine if you have thousands of experts on one side, and then the other side, you have a few handfuls of people. You would say, well, who do we believe? But as a scientist, that isn't enough. So a few years ago, with my colleague Rasmus Benestad from Norway, we took the 37 scientific papers that have been published over the previous 10 or 15 years that said that climate was not changing or that humans weren't responsible or that it was not serious. 37 papers. Now, on the other side, there's thousands, actually millions now. Millions of papers saying it's real, it's serious, it's human caused. But there was 37 papers saying it wasn't. So we took these 37 papers and we reanalyzed their data from scratch. So we started with the very beginning and we basically did 37 studies. And what we found is that in every example, there was at least one error. Sometimes it was a mathematical error or a statistical error. Sometimes they left out something that they really had to include. Sometimes they didn't use all the data. They only used the part of the data that said what they wanted it to. But every single one of those 37 studies, we found at least one mistake that if you corrected it, it brought that study completely into agreement with the millions of studies saying climate is changing, humans are responsible, and the impacts are serious. So the people who say it isn't real or it's not us or it's not serious, they don't have any leg to stand on, as we say in English. How do you say that in German?
What would you say about natural climate influences like the solar activity, ocean cycles, or volcanic eruptions? Do these factors play only a minor role, or are they playing a bigger role in that?
What many people don't understand is that we climate scientists spend more time studying the natural reasons why climate changes than we spend time studying the human causes, because the natural factors are much more complicated and, honestly, from a scientific perspective, much more interesting. So we know that the Earth's temperature has changed in the past. We know it's been warmer and it's been cooler, and we know the number one reason is natural factors. So when we see the Earth's temperature warming as it is today, we don't immediately assume it was humans. First, we looked at all the other factors. It's like, imagine that you were running a fever and you went to see the doctor, and the doctor just looked at you, and without running any tests, the doctor just said, "Ebola, it's Ebola." That would be ridiculous, right? So if you went to the doctor with a fever, they would say, okay, are you sick? What did you eat? Do you have COVID? Do you have the flu? They would run all of these tests before they concluded it was something new. So in the same way, we have been studying this since the 1800s. People don't realize that climate science is very old. And scientists have carefully looked at all of the factors that could cause natural changes in climate. So number one is the sun, because we know that over time, we get more energy from the sun and the world warms, and then we get less energy from the sun and the world cools. It's like if you had a lamp and you turn up the lamp, it gives off more energy. You turn it down, it gives off less energy. So over the last 50 years, what's been happening to the sun's energy? It's been going down. So according to the sun, we should be getting cooler right now, not warmer. Then they say, well, what about orbital cycles? Aren't we just coming out of an ice age? Because we did have an ice age a long time ago. It turns out that the warming from the last ice age peaked about 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. And then global temperature was heading very slowly down, because in about 1,500 years, according to orbital cycles, we should be entering another ice age. So we were actually on the cooling part of the cycle. It takes a very, very long time, though. But instead, we're warming faster and faster. And then people say, okay, so it's not the sun, it's not natural cycles. What about volcanoes? Well, volcanic eruptions actually cool the Earth. When we have a really big volcanic eruption, it produces all of these little particles we call aerosols, and they reflect the sun's energy back to space, keeping the Earth cooler than it would be for weeks, maybe a year. Now, if you add up all the geologic activity in the whole world, like not volcanoes, but, you know, if you've ever been to Sicily or to Yellowstone National Park in the United States or Azerbaijan, they have these places where there's these gases coming out of the ground. And you can kind of smell them, like they smell like rotten eggs. So there is heat-trapping gases coming out of the ground in geologically active places. But if you add up all the heat-trapping gases from all around the world, they are producing as much emissions as Germany and maybe one other country in the EU. That's it. So then there's one more factor, and that is, what about natural cycles inside the climate system, like El Niño? We know that there's natural variability in the exchange of heat between the ocean and the atmosphere and back again, like a teeter-totter or a seesaw. How do you say that in Germany? You know that in the playground, there's like a board or a bar, and one person sits on each end and they go up and down. What's that called?
Wippe.
Yes, exactly. So if you picture that, that's like the ocean and the atmosphere. And so from year to year, more heat goes into the ocean or more heat goes into the atmosphere. So if we were warming due to a natural cycle, that heat would have to be coming from the ocean. So the ocean heat would be going down while the atmospheric heat went up. What's happening? The ocean heat is going up. In fact, it's going up much more than the atmosphere. So we've looked at all these natural factors and they all have an alibi. In fact, according to natural factors, we should be getting cooler right now. And instead, the world is getting warmer faster and faster. So people say, how much of this warming is human caused? And my answer is more than 100%. And you might say, how does that make sense? How could it be more than 100%? It's because according to the sun and natural cycles and volcanoes, we should be getting cooler. And instead, we're getting warmer faster and faster. So all of the warming is human caused. And then we are also compensating for a little bit of natural cooling. Isn't that crazy? Have you ever heard that before?
No, to be honest, not.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds really crazy. And I was wondering if there might be a factor that we just don't know of today. So maybe there's some natural factor that doesn't come to our calculation right now, but is important. Could it be that there's another important factor we just don't know?
There could be. And so this is why I love science so much, is because scientists ask those questions and answer them. So about 20 years ago, a colleague of mine named Bruce Anderson at Boston University, he asked that question. He said, could there be some factor we don't know? But we do know that levels of heat-trapping gases or greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are going up. So we know that carbon dioxide or CO2, we know that methane, CH4, is going up. We have known since the 1850s that human activities like digging up and burning coal and gas and oil are producing these heat-trapping gases that are building up in the atmosphere, wrapping an extra blanket around the planet. And just like you would, if you went to sleep at night and someone snuck into your room and put an extra blanket on you, you'd wake up sweating and you'd say, I'm too hot. I didn't need this extra blanket. That's exactly what's happening with our planet. So what Bruce did in his analysis was he took the very lowest of low bounds on the heat-trapping gases, because we've measured how they've been going up in the atmosphere. But he said, if they absorb the least possible amount of heat, could there be another factor? And he found the answer's no. There's no room for another factor to cause the warming. It really is us. We've checked and we're sure.
I want to raise another question from the audience. There's a history of the Earth. You've mentioned it earlier, and there have been different geological epochs where temperature was significantly higher than today. And when we compare then, we are in a colder phase right now. And why is the current climate change, scientists are so alarmed? Because when it was warmer in the past, maybe it's just a change that will go down in a few years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're totally right. The Earth has been warmer and colder in the past. And the only reason why we know this is because scientists studied it. So when people often say, don't you know? I'm like, I'm a scientist. We're the ones who told you that it's been warmer and cooler in the past. And so I don't study past climate. I study future climate, but I work with many people who study past climate. And when I learn from them what they know about the past, that actually makes me more worried about what's happening today, not less. Let me explain why. The first reason is because when we look in the past, we see that the Earth has gotten warmer before, but never this fast. The closest example to what's happening today happened 55 million years ago. And it's estimated at that time that the world was warming 10 times slower than today. So when you think of all the animals and the plants that have to migrate, as well as all the people that have to migrate, the speed of the change is unprecedented. And then I live in North America, and in North America, many people would say, oh, 55 million years, the Earth didn't exist then. So I say, fine, how old is the Earth? And people say, oh, 6,000 years. And so then I say, okay, if it's 6,000 years, no orbital cycles, no warmer periods in the past. In the last 6,000 years, the Earth's temperature was very, very, very stable. And then just the last 200 years, it went up like this. So if we only look at the last 6,000 years, it's actually more alarming than if we look at the history of the Earth. So the speed of the change is the first reason why we're worried. But the second reason why we're worried is because, as I often say, it's not about saving the Earth, it's about saving us. The Earth will be going around the sun many years after we're gone. The Earth will be fine. If it's warmer, if it's colder, the Earth will endure as long as God wishes it to. But we have never had 8 billion people on the planet with climate changing this fast. We have only been around, our civilization has only been around about 6,000 to 8,000 years. And over that time, climate was as stable as the temperature of the human body. So our human body temperature goes up and down by a few tenths of a degree over the course of every day. And that's normal and natural. Over all of human civilization, the average temperature of the Earth went up and down by a few tenths of a degree. That's normal and natural. But if your body temperature goes up by 1.5 degrees C, you're running a fever, you're taking medicine, you're going to the doctor. You don't feel well. And that's exactly what's happening to our planet. Our Earth's temperature has gone up almost 1.5. It's 1.3 right now, headed towards 1.5 if we don't change our ways. And our Earth is feeling the impacts of that fever. And that fever is affecting us. It's affecting our economy, our food, our water, our health, our infrastructure. Every part of our lives is at risk. So it's not about saving the planet. It's about saving us. The planet will be fine. The question is, will we?
Yeah, you just mentioned that the Earth's climate has gone through dramatic highs and lows in the past. And the question now is, the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change, or short the IPCC, primarily focuses on just the last 150 years as a reference for analyzing climate change. And why is that?
There are a few different reasons. The first reason is that because we are looking specifically at the change in climate caused by humans. And that change, it began a long time ago when we started cutting down trees and developing agriculture, but that was just a bit of change. In fact, it was just enough to balance out the orbital cycles. So remember how we just talked about how according to orbital cycles, we should be heading into the next ice age. But as of the 1800s, because of humans cutting down trees, and we have lots of cows and sheep and goats that produce a lot of methane, mostly from just burping. So if this was the cooling from the orbital cycles, we had offset that. So we basically had stabilized climate, which is perfect. That's just the way we want it. But in the 1800s, that is when the Industrial Revolution really started. And the Industrial Revolution was powered by coal, gas, and oil. So if you want to look at how much has changed, you look back to when did it begin to change? And it began to change in the 1800s. So that's why we often compare where we are today with the 1800s, because that is when the change began. Also, by 1850, that is when we had enough weather stations around the world to have global average temperature calculated from thermometers. We have thermometer data going back to the 1600s. We also have what we call proxy data or natural thermometers, tree rings, ice cores, sediment records, going back thousands, millions, even billions of years. But our actual global thermometer record goes back to 1850. That's the second reason. But the third reason, again, is because it isn't about saving the planet. It's about us humans. And if you look at how our population, our civilization, our industry, our economy, our supply chains, our society, if you look at how it's developed, the last 150 years is when most of that development has happened that has led to climate change. So that period of time makes the most sense to talk about the problem that we're facing and to compare how much worse it's gotten and to look at what we have to accomplish to bring ourselves back to that safe operating space, as scientists call it. Safe operating space for humans, not the planet.
I think the whole discussion about the climate change and talks about this topic can be very emotional. And it seems that some people feel that climate change is being used as a tool to instill fear and gain more control. Do you think that the uncertainties in climate change are being adequately considered? And are we too focused on worst-case scenarios?
I think that fear is being used at both ends of the spectrum. So I definitely do see people who are saying we're all going to die. And I even get attacked by some of those people. I say, no, it's not about all of us, but the people who are suffering the most, the poorest, most vulnerable people, they are being most severely impacted today. So I do see people at one end of the spectrum using fear to say it's all over, there's nothing you can do. But I see a lot of people at the other side also using fear. They say the solutions are worse than just doing what we're doing today. The cure is worse than the disease. Electric cars are worse than internal combustion engines. Clean energy is worse than fossil fuels. Burning fossil fuels produces so much air pollution that it kills almost 9 million people per year. There is no other energy source that is worse than fossil fuels for human health. But there's a lot of fear that people are using to prevent change. Your life will be worse. You can't eat this. You can't go there. You can't have this. You can't do this. There's a lot of fear being used to stop action. So where are we in terms of our projections? Well, about 10 years ago, one of my colleagues, Naomi Oreskes, did a study where she compared 30 years of climate projections from scientists against what really happened. And she found something that did not surprise me as a scientist, but it probably will surprise many other people. She found that scientists, and especially the IPCC and all the big assessment reports, systematically underestimate the speed and the size of change. In fact, it is so pervasive that in her analysis, she actually coined a term, ESLD. It stands for erring on the side of least drama. In other words, she found that scientists systematically underweight and underestimate the worst case scenarios. So what you're getting from scientists might sound very bad, but the reality is it actually could be much worse than we say. And that is scary.
Maybe now to a little more about your opinion. There are prominent climate scientists like Richard Lindzen, John Christie, or Judith Curry who question the urgency of immediate action. What's your opinion on that? And do we really face a climate emergency like that? And I think we already heard a little bit about that.
Yes, I mentioned earlier how you just need the fingers of one hand to count the people who have scientific expertise in this area who say it's not an emergency. And you've just labeled three of the people on that hand. I was very curious, in addition to the analysis I did with my colleague Rasmus Benestad, where we analyzed their papers and we found an error in each one, I was also curious why. Why do they say that it's not an emergency? So I actually got some of their books and I watched some of their talks because I wanted to know why are they saying this? And in every single case, there was political ideology behind their scientific arguments. In fact, in many cases, they would talk more about politics than they would about the science. So if you start from the idea that we don't want to do anything, and then you work your way backwards, that's how you come up with it's not serious, it's not human caused, it's not even happening. Because all of those excuses, like I call them, and literally there's five categories of excuses. Number one, it's not real. Number two, it's not caused by humans. Number three, it's not bad. Warming is better. I come from Canada. Wouldn't we like to be warmer? Number four, solutions don't work. They're too expensive. They're ineffective. It's better to just do what we're always doing. And then you know what number five is? Oh, it's too late. You should have warned us before. Now it's too late. So these might all sound different, but they have the same goal. The goal of every single one of these five arguments is to do nothing. And why do people want to do nothing? It's typically a political or an ideological motivation out of fear. Fear of the solutions, fear of the change, fear of some type of loss of what you can do or what you do have or the power or wealth that you have. And that fear is stoked by some of the richest companies in the world who want to keep us using coal, gas, and oil as long as possible. And so there is definitely fear, but more of that fear is being wielded by the people who want to keep us from acting than the people who do. From a scientific perspective, this is an emergency because if we don't take action now, there is going to be increasing suffering and loss. And we are already being impacted today. It's not a future issue. So an emergency, in my opinion, means something that we need to do something about now. And climate change is something that we need to do something about now. We can't afford to wait any longer.
Yeah, I think it sounds very dangerous if you combine science with the political area, right? Because I think it's a different topic to say there is no climate change or to say this method won't help to stop it. Do you think that there is much, combination of political and climate science?
So it's interesting because I just was reading this morning a global survey of people around the world asking them, do you think that, do you trust scientists? Do you think that scientists should share the results of their information publicly with people? And most people said yes. 78% of people around the world said that they trusted scientists and they wanted scientists to publicly share the information that they got. But then researchers asked, do you think that scientists should be involved in advocating for specific policies? And there the numbers dropped significantly. And that makes sense to me because the way I think about it is a thermometer does not give you a different answer depending on how you vote. A thermometer is not green or red or orange or blue or purple. It doesn't say, excuse me, who did you vote for in the last election before a hurricane rips the roof off your house or a flood destroys your basement? So is climate change real and serious and do we need to take action? Those are not political questions. Those are scientific questions. And the answer is yes. But when it comes to the solutions, what are the best solutions? For one city, it might be different than another city. For one organization, it might be different for another organization. For a country, this group of people might say, this is the best solution. And this group might say, no, no, no. According to my values, this is the best solution. So that's why scientists are not enough. We need scientists, but we also, of course, we need engineers. We need economists, we need legal professionals, we need medical professionals, we need policy experts. And my dream is to have all of our politicians arguing, because that's what politicians do best. I want them arguing over who has the best solutions to climate change. I want them arguing and fighting and campaigning over who has the best solutions. And then all of us can listen to the policymakers and the decision makers and the politicians, and we can say, okay, here are three different parties and they have three different solutions. I'm going to vote for the one I think is best. That's the way I think it should be done.
I want to raise another question from the audience. The IPCC bases its predictions about the risk of exceeding the 1.5 degree threshold on a variety of methods and data sources, climate models, historical and geological data, ice sheet analysis and ocean currents. And this diversity inevitably introduces uncertainties that affect the accuracy of forecasts. Could it be that the risk of climate change are being overestimated?
So this is my research area. I specifically study future projections. And what I have learned is that the biggest uncertainty in future projections is us. We humans, the decisions that we will make is the biggest uncertainty past the next 10 years. So over a few years, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, the biggest uncertainty is natural variability. Remember, we talked about that teeter-totter or seesaw in the exchange of heat between the ocean and the atmosphere. That's the biggest uncertainty short-term over a year, 2 years, 3 years. There's also uncertainty in the climate models. And that uncertainty is especially large for precipitation, rain or snow, more than temperature. And it's also larger at the very, very small scale. So an individual city or an individual region compared to the country or the larger area. But when we go past 10 years, for most places around the world, for temperature, heat waves, heavy rain events, droughts, the biggest source of uncertainty is the decisions that we make. Because today, the amount that natural variability is controlling the climate is about this big, and the amount that humans are controlling the climate is about this big. And so this is the biggest source of uncertainty. So what I do when I look at the future is I say, if we decide to do this, here's what will happen with an uncertainty range around it. But if we decide to do this, here's what will happen with an uncertainty range around it. And again, past about 10 years, the biggest uncertainty are the choices that we make today. So that is, it's both a little bit of a scary result, but I think it's also a result that makes us feel like what we do matters. So if our choices are the biggest uncertainty, that means that what we do actually makes a difference. So we should be doing something because we will see what difference it makes with our own eyes in our own lifetime.
Did you know, probably you know, but do you mind telling us which specific data sources and climate models are used to monitor and confirm climate change? And are there any websites or platforms where this information is clearly laid out for us?
Yes. So the answer is we use pretty much everything that we can. Everything. So obviously, I mentioned earlier that we use weather stations. And weather stations measure temperature, humidity, wind speed, precipitation, cloudiness, all kinds of other things. We also use buoys in the ocean. So these are like floating things that float in the ocean, like floating weather stations. We also use satellites. And satellites, of course, can measure all around the world all the time, especially in some places that don't have a lot of ground-based instruments. We also use what we call aircraft campaigns, where they fly airplanes through specific areas, like into the middle of a hurricane and things like that. But we also use historical data. So we get historical data from tree rings, from ice cores, from little fossils in the mud at the bottom of lakes, or even at the bottom of the ocean. We even use historical records, like historical records on when the grapes were harvested every year, or historical paintings of glaciers that we can take pictures of today to see how they've changed. Historical records of when the river froze. So when did they have a festival on the river? Because the river was frozen. We use all the data we can. And around the world, we have over 40 big global climate models. There's several in Germany. There's a couple in Canada. There's a lot of them in the United States. There's a big one in the UK. France has one. Germany has one. Australia has one. A lot of big countries have their own climate models, but they apply those models to the whole world. And what we have is we have something called the Coupled Model Intercomparison Project, CMIP. And every 5 or 6 years, all of the climate models in the world run the same scenarios. The same scenarios are the choices that people make. What types of energy, what types of policy, how many people, all that. So every 5 or 6 years, all of the climate models run the same scenarios and they put them all together. And then the IPCC takes that information and makes all their summary graphs. So where do you find this? Well, NASA has a lot of this archived. You can look at a lot of the data yourself. There's a really good resource called Climate at a Glance that the United States National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration puts on. And you can look at cities around the world. You can look at countries around the world for how the temperature and precipitation has changed. The IPCC reports also have a good summary. There's typically national summaries. A lot of countries have national summaries. And if you go to my website, which is just my name, katherinehayhoe.com, I have a list of frequently asked questions. And one of the first questions is, where do I find this information and this data? And so I have a lot of links so people can go look at it themselves.
Yeah, thank you for that. But even with all the informations, we know that models don't have to predict the future or the true future. And in the past, there have been some predictions that didn't come true, such as the global cooling fears of the 1970s. Why should it be different this time?
Yes. So in the 1970s, that was when scientists were studying the impact of not only humans, but also all the natural factors we talked about. And if you remember in the 1970s, that was when the energy from the sun started to go down. And scientists also realized that according to orbital cycles, we should be heading into another ice age. So if you only look at orbital cycles in the sun and you leave humans out of the picture, we should be getting cooler, but we're not. But even back then in the 1970s, scientists knew that humans were causing climate to change. So if you look at all of the scientific studies published between 1965 and 1979, so 15 years, they found that 62% of those studies predicted global warming. 28% of the studies didn't make a prediction. And only 10% of those studies predicted cooling. So even then, 62% of the studies were predicting warming. And now, of course, over 99% of the studies are predicting warming. And the ones that are not predicting warming, as I said, the 37 papers we found in the last 10 years, they all had a mistake in them. That if you fix them, they're predicting warming too.
Okay, so you made your position very clear that we have to do something immediately. So what's your take on Germany pursuing climate goals with just 2% of global CO2 emissions? While major emitters like China or the USA are making very little effort, wouldn't an adaptation strategy be more realistic, given that we can't save the climate without the big players like them?
Well, this is a question that I hear a lot because I'm Canadian, and Canada is also responsible for 2%. So Germany and Canada, it's the same. And in Canada, the thing is, we're a very big country. And a lot of our economy in Canada depends on oil and gas. So in Canada, people say not only we're only 2%, but they say, but look at our economy. The biggest part of our economy is our natural resources. And a lot of our natural resources are oil and gas. So why should we do anything? Well, first of all, we realize that when we look at our contributions, Canada and Germany, Canada is actually, I think, number 9 in the world. And so Germany is probably not that far behind. Yes, at the top, we have China, the US and India, but then a lot of EU countries, Australia is also up there too, compared to Zimbabwe or Yemen or Indonesia, we're still very close to the top. Also, we all have responsibility because we all share this planet. We can't put up walls. If you could put up walls around Germany all the way to the top of the atmosphere, and you could say, we're just living in our own little bubble, it doesn't matter what the rest of the world does, then you could make your own decisions. But our atmosphere is shared. And what you produce in Germany will affect this country over here, and what this country over here does will also affect you. So when we make decisions in our own country, because we're interconnected, our businesses are connected, our economy is connected, our technology is connected, we are not only making decisions in our own country, we're influencing countries outside our own country as well. We are investing in the future because if we don't change, we're going to be left behind. So it's interesting because we're speaking right after the United States just got a new president. And the day that he began to be president, he announced that he was going to remove a policy on encouraging electric vehicle adoption. So there was a policy that by 2030, half of the vehicles sold in the US needed to be electric. And he decided to reverse that. And he said, why should we do anything and just let China pollute? So I went and I looked at the data for China. Did you know that in China, as of 2024, more than half the cars people were buying in China were electric vehicles already? Last year, China installed more solar energy in 1 year than the United States has in its entire history. It's estimated that China's emissions have already peaked, and they're starting to go down. They're still using coal, but they have more solar and wind energy than any other country around the world. But I live in the United States now, and I live in Texas, which most people would say, well, Texas isn't doing anything, is it? Yes, Texas has more wind energy and more solar energy than any other state in the United States. And right now, they are building a lot of capacity in storage, battery storage, and underground energy storage, and in geothermal energy, because they've learned new ways to get heat energy from the ground. You don't only have to be in Iceland. You can do it other places too. So the idea that we're doing everything and nobody else is doing anything is just completely false. If we look around the world, every country is doing something. We have cities, we have provinces, states, departments, companies, organizations. And so every week I have a newsletter called Talking Climate. And every week I highlight people who are taking action. So this week it was cities, the city of Chicago, the city of Vancouver, the city of Adelaide in Australia, cities that are actually entirely powered by clean energy. Last week, I talked about Finland. Finland is doing amazing things. They have the biggest sand battery in the world. They are storing heat in underground caves. Enough heat to power a city for weeks. They have a special fund that provides green business loans to small businesses who might not have the money that big businesses have. So there's things happening all around the world. And honestly, if we don't take action, we're going to be left behind. And so that's, I think, what's going to happen in the United States the next 4 years is the United States is going to be left behind technologically because it's as if 100 years ago, they were investing in horses and buggies instead of cars. That's like what investing in the old ways of getting energy are today compared to investing in the new ways that China and India and increasing the EU is investing in as well.
But I wonder, do you see these actions like in China and also in the US and other countries, do you see it in the data that maybe the situation becomes better, or is it just, in Germany we say, a Tropfen auf den heißen Stein, just a small piece of water on a hot stone?
Yes, just a drop of water in the bucket. So to understand what data to look at, we have to, I use a swimming pool as an example. So if you imagine the swimming pool is the atmosphere, and the level of water in the swimming pool is the level of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere, the CO2, the carbon dioxide, methane, other heat-trapping gases. At the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we put a hose in the swimming pool, and we've been turning the hose up every year. So the level of water in the swimming pool has been going up, but it's been going up faster and faster because every year we're turning the hose up. So what do we have to do? First, we have to stop turning the hose up. Then we have to turn the hose down. And the level of water in the pool will keep on going up until we turn the hose off or until the drain equals the hose. So part of our climate solutions is not only turning the hose off, but also making the drain bigger. That's investing in nature. Because nature wants to take that carbon out of the atmosphere and put it back into soil and forests and grasslands. So when we make the drain bigger and we turn off the hose, we can, if once the net is zero, that's where net zero comes from, what's coming out the hose equals what's going down the drain, then the water will stop. So that's why when we look at the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, That's the level of water in the pool. We will see the impact of our actions last when we look at the amount of water in the pool, global average carbon dioxide and global temperature. What we have to do is we have to look at what's coming out the hose and what's going down the drain first. And what we see is that the hose is starting to slow down. So we've been accelerating faster and faster and faster and faster every year. And now we're starting to go like this. It's still not enough. The water is still going up, but we are actually seeing an inflection point. And once we see an inflection point, what history tells us is that there are tipping points, not only in the physical climate system, like tipping points like ocean circulation in the physical system, there's tipping points in human society. And when we reach that tipping point, like in Norway, for example, they've reached the tipping point for electric vehicles. In China, of course, they've reached that tipping point too. When we reach the tipping point, change happens very quickly. So people are looking for those tipping points in society in terms of what's coming out of the hose. And we are starting to see those tipping points already.
That's interesting and also very good to hear. We want to not move to another topic, but combine it with something that is very personal to you. You are not only a renowned climate scientist, you are also a committed evangelical Christian. And evangelical Christians are often stereotyped as climate skeptics. Not all of them, but some of them, maybe many of them. How do you reconcile these two aspects of your identity?
Well, growing up in Canada, I had never met somebody who didn't think climate change was real until I moved to the U.S. And in the U.S., I soon learned that many people in the U.S. who are Christians say that climate change isn't real. And now when I'm outside the U.S., in France or Germany or Ireland or Korea, if I meet someone who's Christian and we start talking about climate change, if they tell me they don't think it's real, I ask them where they heard that. And almost every single time they heard it from an American source. In fact, one of my colleagues in France, Jean-François Mouhot, who works with a Christian conservation organization called Arasha, he is a historian. And so he did an analysis of climate denial in evangelical circles in France. And he actually tracked all of the writings and the books and the speeches, anything that he saw in France, he tracked it all back to American sources. So it's really interesting because, first of all, it's all coming from one place, but the Bible's the same Bible. Doesn't matter if it's in German or French or English or Korean, it's the same Bible. So why is only this part of the church saying it's not real? So a colleague of mine, John Evans, did a study 15 years ago now, where he's a sociologist and he's very good at studying what is the cause and what is the symptom. So what is the root and then what is the symptom? And he found that the cause of this is not where people go to church. The cause is political ideology. The more conservative people are politically, the more likely they are to say it's not real. But in the United States, over the past 50 years, there's been a lot of effort. And there's a very good book called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind by historian Mark Knoll. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. I don't know if it's been translated into German, but it's a very, very good book that explains how in the US, over the last 50 years, people have deliberately tried to bring religion and political ideology together. And today, in the United States, 40% of people who say that they are evangelical don't go to church. And if they don't go to church, where are they learning what they believe? They're learning about it from television, social media, radio, politicians. They're not learning about it from the Bible. So in my opinion, what is climate change other than a failure to love our sisters and our brothers and every living thing that the book of Genesis chapter 1 says that we have responsibility over every living thing? Jesus told his disciples we should be recognized by our love for others. And then at the end of the Bible, it says, God will destroy those who destroy the earth. So the reason why I'm a climate scientist is because I'm a Christian. If I wasn't a Christian, I would be an astronomer. I was studying astronomy and I was planning to be an astronomer, but I took a class on climate change. And that was where I learned that climate change affects us all, but it doesn't affect us equally. It affects the poorest, the most marginalized people the most, the very people who Jesus told us to love. Climate change is not fair. And that's why I truly believe climate change is basically a failure to love. And what is climate action other than loving our global neighbor as ourselves? So last September, I had the ability to speak at the Lausanne Congress, which is a gathering of 10,000 evangelical leaders from around the world. And in that talk, I can give you the link for the video so people can watch it. I laid out not the physical science, but I laid out the reasons from the Bible why I think climate action matters to Christians. And my conclusion is that if we truly believe what the Bible says, I think we would be at the front of the line demanding climate action, not dragging our feet at the back.
Yes, thank you. Next, I have a quote from you. It is, Jesus should be the center of my life. When and why did you say that and how do you mean it?
That's a funny question. I was reading it earlier and honestly, I don't remember when I said that. but I really believe that we believe that we are new creations. We believe that we have been created with a new heart to love others as we have been loved ourselves by God. We believe that we are to walk in the good works that God has prepared for us in advance. And so for me right now, I feel like the good works that I am called to walk in is what I do right now, working on and telling people about climate change and why it matters. But what really matters, the Apostle Paul says, is when our faith expresses itself through love. And we also believe that we're all part of a body. And somebody might be a finger, somebody might be a brain cell, somebody might be part of the eyes. So we all have different roles to play, but all of our roles are characterized by working together and, I believe, by expressing God's love to others. And so for me, that's what the center of our life is about. It's who God has made us and who Jesus has called us to be in this world.
Catherine, I have one last question for you. When I hear climate scientists, there are not many optimistic voices out there. I think maybe I just don't hear it. Maybe it's because I'm a German. We are not so optimistic people. Don't know. But what gives you hope when it comes to climate change?
Well, my two favorite Bible verses have nothing to do with nature. There's a lot of very good Bible verses about how God loves nature and creation, but my two favorite verses come from the Apostle Paul. So first of all, in the book of Timothy, he talks about fear. And he says, God has not given us a spirit of fear. So when we see fear on one side, the world's going to end, there's nothing we can do, or fear on the other side, we can't change, all these changes will be worse. Neither one of those come from God. He hasn't given us that fear. Instead, it says, God has given you a spirit of power. And why that matters is because if we're afraid, we're often paralyzed. And if we're paralyzed, we can't act. But if you have power, it means you're empowered to act. So God has given us the ability to act. And then it says with love. So thinking of others, not just ourselves. And the last part I love, with a sound mind. So making good decisions, which I think includes the science of what's happening and why. So I love that verse about how God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of love or power, love, and a sound mind. And then in the book of Romans, Paul talks about hope. And he does not begin with positive circumstances. Because if everything's going well, you don't need hope. Everything's fine. But Paul began with suffering. And he said, suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance produces character. Character produces hope. And what do we put that hope in? The hope is not in people. It's not in a government or a politician or legislation. The hope is in God. That is where our hope is placed. And so Paul didn't say this, but the way I think about hope is that it's not an emotion, it's a practice. I practice hope. I practice it like an Olympic sport. I practice it like I want to, it's a race that I want to win. And so I go out and I look for reasons to be hopeful. I actively look for them, because if we just look at the news is full of bad news all the time. In fact, my newsletter this week is about how the news is full of bad news because that's what people click on. I go out and I look for positive information and I share it with other people. And that's how I practice hope, because if we don't think that what we do will make a difference, we will do nothing. So understanding that what we do makes a difference, for me, that's the definition of hope. What we do can make a difference. That is what gives us the ability to act. And that ability to act, as we know, will affect the biggest uncertainty in our future projections. What we do is the biggest uncertainty. And so that is why we need love, we need faith, and we need hope to power our batteries, so to speak, in this fight for a better future for us all.
Wow. Thank you so much, Catherine. I think that were really, really good words, and it was a fascinating talk and also very helpful. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Yeah, we are also very interested what you think about this episode. Maybe you have some other questions. We just could take a few of them. And we also want to have feedback from you, so please let us know what you think about this episode. We wish you a nice day. See you again. Bye.